Okay, all right. This is from Samna Untar Mahabua. This talk is The Middleness of the Middle Way. This is the first one. It's rather short, and then I'll read a short bit by a talk given by Thanajan Piak to some monks from Wapananachat who were going on Tudong to Daldam. So, Untar Mahabua. I can tell a resolute person when I see him, like the Venerable Ajahn Mun. It was intimidating just to look at him. How could mental defilements not be intimidated by him? Even we monks were intimidated by him, and the defilements were smarter than we are, so how could they not be intimidated? They had to be intimidated. That's the way things have to be. A teacher who possesses the Dhamma, who possesses virtue, has to be resolute so as to eliminate evil. He must be really resolute. The stronger the evil, the more resolute and strong his goodness has to be. It can't afford not to be resolute and strong, otherwise goodness will lose out. Suppose this place is dirty, however dirty it may be. We can't clean it with just by splashing it with a glass of water, can we? We'd have to use a lot of water to make it clean. If this place were filled with a pile of excrement, we'd have to splash it with a whole bucket of water, and not just an ordinary bucket, a great big one. A mighty splash, and all the excrement would be scattered. The place would become clean because the water was stronger. Being resolute means being earnest toward everything of every sort within the bounds of reason. Take this and think it over. If you act weakly when training yourself, you're not on the path. You have to be strong in fighting the mind's defilements. Don't let the strong defilements step all over you. If we don't have any way of fighting defilements, if we're weak and irresolute, we're not good for much at all. For those who want what is clean and good from the Dhamma, what is the Dhamma like? What did the Buddha teach? What sort of defilement is eliminated by what sort of Dhamma so that it deserves to be called the middle way? The Buddha taught the middle way realized by the Tathagata, producing vision, producing realization, leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to Nibbana. This is in the discourse on setting the wheel of Dhamma in motion. The middle way can cause all these forms of knowledge to arise. Realization is penetrative knowledge that's very subtle and sharp. Self-awakening is even more subtle and sharp than penetrative knowledge. They all constitute the path leading to Nibbana. All of these things, without exception, come from the middle way. They do not lie beyond the range of the middle way at all. What does the word middle mean? Are middleness as it is in reality and middleness we study, memorize, and speculate on really so different? Yes, very different. I'll give you an example. Suppose there are two soldiers, both of whom have studied the full course of military science. One of them has never been in the battle lines, while the other has had a lot of experience on the battlefield, to the point where he just barely escaped with his life. Which of the two can speak more accurately and fluently about the reality of fighting in a war? We have to agree without hesitation that the soldier who has been in battle can speak of every facet in line with the events he has seen and encountered to the extent that he was able to come out alive. If he were stupid, he would have died. He had to have been intelligent in order to survive. So the middle way, how is it middle? We've been taught that following the middle way means being neither too lax nor too extreme. So how do we make sure that our practice is not too lax or too extreme, so that it's in line with the principle of middleness aimed at by the genuine Dhamma? Suppose after we sit in meditation for a while, we become afraid that we'll ache, or faint, or die, or our body will be crippled, or we'll go crazy. So we tell ourselves, our practice is too extreme. Understand? If we think of making a donation, we say, no, that'd be a waste. We do better to use it for this or that. So what is this? Do you understand whose middleness this is? If we're going to follow the way of the Dhamma, we say it's too extreme. But if we're going to follow the way of defilements, we're ready for anything, without a thought for middleness at all. So whose middleness is this? It's just the middleness of the defilements, because the defilements have their middleness too. When some people do good actions because they desire to go to heaven or desire to attain Nibbana, they worry that this desire is a form of craving. But when they want to go to hell in this very life, they don't worry about whether it's craving or not. They don't even think about it. When they go into a bar, is this craving? They don't stop to think about it. When they drink liquor or fool around with the waves of deprivation, is this the middle way or not? Is this craving? Is this defilement or not? They don't bother to think. But when they think of turning to the realm of Dhamma, then their desires become too extreme. Everything becomes too extreme. What is this? Doesn't the thought ever occur to us that these are the opinions of the defilements dragging us along? The defilements dress things up just fine. Their real middleness is in the middle of the pillow, the middle of the sleeping mat. As soon as we do a little walking meditation and think Buddha, Dhammo, Sangho, it's as if we're being taken to our death, as if we're tied to a leash like a monkey squirming and jumping about, until we let go of the Buddha that will lead us to safety. Whether we're going to give alms, observe the precepts, or practice meditation, we're afraid that we'll faint and die from the exertion. The defilements are putting up obstacles and blocking our way at every step. We don't realize what the middleness of the defilements is like because it's been lulling us to sleep all along. Just now, I mentioned the two soldiers who had studied military science, one of whom had gone into battle while the other one hadn't. We can compare this to studying the texts. Those who have gone into battle, who have had experience dealing with defilements by fighting against them, are the ones who can describe the middle way correctly and accurately. If you simply study and memorize, here, I'm not belittling study. Study all you can, memorize all you can. I'm not criticizing memorization, but if you simply memorize the names of the defilements, even if you memorize their entire ancestry, it doesn't mean a thing if you aren't intent on the practice. If you don't practice, it's just like memorizing the names of the different criminals. How this or that gang of criminals operates, how it makes its money, what it likes to do, what the members' names are. We can memorize these things. We can even memorize their family tree. But if we don't get into action and deal with them, those criminals whose names we can remember will keep on harming the world. So merely memorizing names doesn't serve any useful purpose. We have to get into action and lay down a strategy. What kind of places do those criminals usually rob? What are their preferred targets? We then take our strategy and put it into practice, lying in wait for them at this place and that, until we can catch them. Society can then live in peace. This is the realm of practice. The same holds true with the mental defilements and their outflows. We have to practice in order to deal with them. Once we know their ways, we put that knowledge into practice. What is it like to give alms? We know because we've already given. What is it like to observe the precepts? We've already observed them. What is it like to meditate? We've already done it. This is called practice. It's not that we simply memorize that giving alms has results like that, observing the precepts has results like this, meditation has results like that, heaven is like this, nibbana is like that. If we simply repeat these things by rote, without being interested in the practice, we won't get to go there. We won't achieve any of the results. So focus on the practice of fighting the defilements. The defilements have been the enemies of the Dhamma from time immemorial. The Buddha taught that the defilements are the enemies of the Dhamma. Where do they lie? Right here, in the human heart. Where does the Dhamma lie? In the human heart as well. This is why it's important for human beings to counteract their defilements. In fighting the defilements, we will have to suffer some pain and discomfort as a matter of course. Whatever weapons they use, whatever the mode of attack, whatever their tactics, the Dhamma has to stay focused on its attack. The techniques used in eliminating the defilements, such as sidestepping, jabbing, punching, and charging, all have to be done in line with the principles of the Dhamma, such as right views and right attitudes, which circle round and round the enemy. Practicing in this way, we are able to gradually subdue the defilements. This is what is really meant by the middle way. So go ahead and desire. Desire to gain release from suffering. Desire to gain merit. Desire to go to heaven. Desire to go to nibbana. Go ahead and desire these results as much as you like, because they're all part of the path. It's not true that all desire is craving. If we don't allow any desires because we think that all desire is craving, then it's as if we were already dead. Nothing is accomplished in life without desire. That's not what it means to eliminate defilements and craving. Such a person is nothing special at all, because he's a dead person. A person who isn't dead has to want this and that. Just be careful that you don't go wanting in the wrong direction, that's all. If you want in the wrong direction, it means craving defilement. If you want in the right direction, it's the path, so make sure you understand this. The stronger our desire, the more resolute our persistence will be. Desire and determination are part of the path, the way to gain release from suffering. When our desire to go to heaven, to attain nibbana, or to gain release from suffering is strong, making us brave in the fight, then our persistence, our stamina, and our fighting spirit are pulled together into a single strength by our intention to attain nibbana and be released from suffering. These factors keep working constantly, with no concern for the time of the day, the month, or the year. They simply keep battling all the time. When the desire gets that strong, meditators must be resolute. No matter how many defilements there are, they'll be made to succumb. We can't afford to retreat. We must remain doggedly determined to destroy the defilements. If they don't collapse first, then we're prepared to retreat if we're no match for them. But the word surrender does not exist in the heart. If they kick us out of the ring, we climb right back in to fight again. If they kick us out again, we climb back in again and keep on fighting. After this happens many times, we can start kicking the defilements out of the ring instead. Each time we are kicked and hit, we learn a lesson. Whenever we lose to the defilements, we regroup and counterpunch, using their own tactics to counteract them. Eventually, we'll be able to fend them off. As the defilements gradually become weaker, matters of Dhamma, mindfulness, samadhi, wisdom, and persistence become stronger and stronger. This is when the defilements have to cower at our feet because they're no match for the Dhamma. Before, we were the only ones cowering. When we cowered, the defilements beat up on us. Lying down, we'd cry and moan. Sitting, we'd moan. Standing, we'd feel longing. Walking, we'd feel longing and hunger. Wherever we'd go, there would be nothing but love, hate, and anger filling the heart. There'd be nothing but defilements stopping all over us. But once those things are struck down by mindfulness, wisdom, and conviction, and persistence, they no longer arise, no matter where we go, because the defilements are the ones cowering. As they keep on cowering, we continue probing for them without let-up. When we find one, we kill it. When we find another one, we kill it, until the defilements are completely eradicated, with nothing left to disturb the heart. After that, when we talk about defilements, no matter what kind, we can talk with assurance. Whatever tricks and tactics we've employed to shed the defilements, we can describe them without hesitation. The purity of the heart that has no more defilements ruining it as before, we can describe with certainty. This is like the person who has gone into battle and can speak about the experience without hesitation. It's not the same as when we simply memorize. If we simply memorize, we can speak only in line with the texts. We can elaborate. We can't elaborate the least little bit. We don't know how. But a person who has gone into battle knows all the ins and outs, not merely the military science of how to do things in battle. He understands the situation from every angle and can navigate every circumstance skillfully, focusing on what actions are needed to reach safety or to gain victory. A fighter uses whatever means is necessary. It's the same with us when we fight the defilements. Whatever tactics are needed to win, the Buddha has provided all the necessary weapons of Dhamma for us to activate with our own mindfulness and wisdom. True practitioners never run out of rope, you know. When we really come to the end of our rope, then mindfulness and wisdom produce ways for us to help ourselves so that we can continue to bash the defilements to bits until no more are left. From that point on, wherever the defilements bring in their armies, in whatever form, we know them all because they've been entirely eliminated from our hearts. This is the practice of the middle way. When the defilements come charging in, the middle way goes charging out to meet them. If they bring in a big army, the middle way fights them off with a big army. If they're hard-hitting, we're hard-hitting. If they're daredevils, we're daredevils. This is what's meant by the middle way, the appropriate way for defeating the army of the enemy. If their army is large while ours is small and their efforts few, it just won't work. We're bound to lose. However large their army and however many their weapons, our army must be larger and our weapons superior. Only then will we win. This is known as the army of Dhamma. However large the defiling army may be, mindfulness, wisdom, conviction, and persistence have to charge in and treat them with a heavy hand. Finally, the defilements will be laid out cold, and there will be no need to chant a funeral service for them. We will have finally gained the superlative Dhamma, the Dhamma that is sanditikong, directly visible. The teachings of the Buddha are an open market of the paths, fruitions, and nibbana, which are never out of date, unless we ourselves are out of date. Only then will we let the defilements fool us into thinking that the Dhamma is out of date, that people who enter monasteries and practice the Dhamma are old-fashioned and out of date, that the teachings of the religion have no paths or fruitions, that the paths, the fruitions, and nibbana no longer exist, that no matter how much you practice, you'll just wear yourself out in vain. These attitudes are nothing but the defilements deceiving us, and we believe everything they tell us, keeping us continually bankrupt without even a scrap of goodness to our name. For that reason, we must be resolute in our desire to see the truth. It's there in the hearts of every person. The Buddha did not lay any exclusive claims to it. All that's needed is that we practice. Don't doubt the paths, the truth of the paths, the fruitions, and nibbana. When have the defilements ever been out of date? They're fashionable in our hearts at all times. Why are they never criticized? Why are they never accused of being old-fashioned? We've never even given a thought to criticizing them. And how is it that the Dhamma, which is the remedy for the defilements, has seemingly vanished? The Dhamma is a pair with the defilements. They exist together in the heart, but the defilements just lull us to sleep so that we don't use the Dhamma to defeat them. They're afraid of losing their power because defilements are intimidated by Dhamma, which is why they deceive us into ignoring its presence. Take this to heart and remember it well. What time is it? 10? Oh. Okay. It's a short one. I'll skip a bit in. Actually, meditation is not that difficult. Actually, meditation is not that difficult. At least that's my opinion. But the problem is that you don't know the method of doing things. Sometimes, when you are just about to reach peacefulness, you start making it unpeaceful again. This is the crucial point, the reason why peace won't come up. Sometimes you start thinking, wow, this really feels good, but hey, wait a moment, am I really doing things correctly? This is where doubts come into play, where the hindrances arise. You go off thinking something else and make it all unpeaceful again. If you kept letting things go freely, as it is their original course, they would unfold in a natural way. But there is always a point where everybody starts worrying. Me too. I also had doubts. It's not only you. When I came into this phase, I went thinking, am I really doing things correctly? Did the Kruba Ajahns do it this way? Does this really lead to peace? There are all kinds of variations that can be produced by our minds, preventing our hearts from becoming peaceful. Try to get rid of these mind states. Try to keep going and stay unconcerned, unhurried, and cool. No need to be afraid of not getting to peacefulness. To say it simply, one needs to keep doing the practice anyway, whether it's peaceful or not. One really needs to accept everything. If you keep thinking, peaceful or not, I don't care, then you'll get to peace. If you only want the peaceful states, you'll go worrying, is this really it or not? Then you're really confused, and your heart is even less peaceful than before. If you were to simply let it go according to its own logic, it will automatically flow where it naturally inclines to. Don't overdo sitting with your eyes closed. Do everything well balanced. In the beginning, breathe in very deeply, fully pump all your lungs up with air. Then let it all out and relax and start again with another full breath. Then release the air again. Don't think of anything else then. Try to be only in the present. Just that is enough. As concerns the contents of your brain, just try to take your awareness away from it, keeping it with its object. When there are still thoughts and they don't stop, try to get them to knowing the in and out breaths. That's already enough. Everything will develop on its own. Don't hurry. Keep patient. Do it continually. Don't rush yourself into wanting something. If you're impatient and you want to get something, you won't get it. Keep doing the practice on and on, whether it's peaceful or unpeaceful. This is what Lumpa Cha said. If it's peaceful, keep practicing. If it's not peaceful, keep practicing. If you're lazy, keep practicing. If you're diligent, keep practicing. When you feel lazy, you don't want to practice. It's only when you feel energetic that you do it. So this is the problem. What do you do when one is lazy? This is where it's difficult. When peace arises, everybody wants peace, but if it's not peaceful, there's nobody that wants to sit meditation. Of course, I can understand how you feel. If somebody doesn't get calm during a two-hour sit, there will be 1,000 issues that he'll be thinking of, where somebody who is peaceful just sits down and after a while opens his eyes again, saying he didn't experience anything apart from feeling good all the time. I do understand your problem. The two experiences don't feel the same. They are opposites. But still, one needs to bear with what comes. Suppose today you sit meditation and it becomes completely unpeaceful. You think, man, I wanted to meditate, but during this whole hour, all I've been doing is thinking, what's the use of all this? It's not that I haven't had these experiences before. I have also encountered a lot of unpeacefulness. I know what it's like, sitting for a whole hour, thinking here and there, no samadhi at all. Really, I'm not lying. I'm speaking of real experiences. I know how it is. But I always kept patient, improving bit by bit. No peace. So what? Start again. Doesn't matter that there's no peace. Give it another try. I was encouraging myself. If the meditation is not peaceful, it doesn't matter. If I just keep doing it on and on, there has to be some peace, at least one time. Whether it was really going to become peaceful or not, I didn't know. But nevertheless, I kept on thinking like this for the time being in order to give myself encouragement. This is how I got over unpeaceful times, giving myself the advice that it's all not sure, and that in the future I might come to peace. I was, but if you keep saying it is difficult, of course, then... keeping it up, I gained encouragement and finally became calm. Surely this is difficult, but if you keep saying it is difficult, of course, then it is difficult. If you say it is easy, then it is easy. It's really easy. I don't know how to call it. It's all a problem of not developing the point where it is just right. If you have found it, though, everything comes down to being well-balanced in itself. One can't know, really, where the point of just rightness lies, but if one really does the practice, the right balance will become self-evident. Talking about the middle way is so difficult, because for one person, it may be a certain way, but for some other person, it may be different again. It depends on the individual. Everyone has to go out and find it for himself. One can't tell someone else where the balance lies. Everyone has to try it out on his own until he knows. But if you don't do the practice, you won't know. And when you already tried it out and don't seem to get anything out of it, and if somebody else says he does, you go arguing with each other without end. Isn't that how it goes? Take somebody who learns easily when studying and passes the exams, whereas another person fails them. The one who fails the exams will complain, "I have studied, but I didn't get it. It was so hard, I nearly died." The one who passed will say, "I didn't find it hard at all. The questions were really easy." So what to say? It's difficult to talk about how people feel about things. Whatever standard that lies in the middle should do. That means not to force things too much and not be too lax. This is enough. It is not a question of whether or not you will become peaceful. This isn't the problem. The problem is not to give up practicing. Continually keep on practicing and you will attain peacefulness. But right now, whether you're a monk, a novice, or a layperson, when you don't become peaceful, you don't want to practice. This is exactly what destroys the peace, what prevents peacefulness from developing. If you're not peaceful, you need to go for it each and every day. That's it. You really don't need to be worried if it's not calm. It doesn't matter. Tomorrow you can start again, no problem. We can restart over and over. That's how to do it. If you all practice in this way, I believe for sure that each and every one of you will find peace. Don't give up too early, every one of you. You are worried that you're not peaceful, that you don't have the barmy the Krupa Ajahns had, like Lumpu Man. They have built up huge amounts before. They really had it easy. All they needed to do was sit down, and in no time, they were already gone beyond, not experiencing anything anymore. If you think like this, you can give up straight away. You might as well stop practicing at once. You have to practice fighting to the last. No peace, never mind. Try to encourage yourselves over and over. It doesn't matter if it's not peaceful. Tomorrow it'll work. It's going to become peaceful. Keep going on and on. That's the way. Fighting relentlessly, unremittingly. The more you practice, the better. Even if you're about to fall asleep, when you're drowsy or agitated, so what? Always bring to your mind that you can begin with a fresh start again and again. You shouldn't give way to moods of happiness and frustration, thinking, "Peaceful enough for today, I've had enough," or "It's so unpeaceful, I better stop." This won't work. You can't do it that way. You need to carry on. As I just said, if you don't experience peace when you are meditating, you wonder, wouldn't it be better to stop, as you've only been thinking for the whole hour anyway? You wanted to sit samadhi, but you keep thinking without end. I've gone through all this myself. When you finally open your eyes, you can't even remember all the stuff you have been thinking of. That's how it goes. But nevertheless, you have to keep going for it. You have to resist and be endurant. If you haven't got it yet, don't worry. Just don't stop doing the practice. If you practice without giving up, you will attain to peacefulness. These are not my words. These are the words of Lumpa Cha. Try to give yourself encouragement. Even if it's not peaceful, encourage yourselves over and over. You can trick yourself. Tell yourself that wherever you go, there have to be obstacles. And here, the obstacles are actually only your own thinking. It's not even the case that the obstacles we have to face lie in other people's thinking. It all comes from ourselves. Our thoughts aren't obstacles that other people have created. It's our own thinking that isn't right. Right view and wrong view is something entirely personal. Nobody else can do the understanding for us. We think our thoughts all alone. The Krupa Ajahns, our friends and other people, they don't know. Even if we are sitting together, they can't know for us. We know individually for ourselves. This is the point that you need to understand. Thinking is entirely personal. Nobody knows for us. Only we know ourselves. Sometimes at the meditation time, we see some other monk. Excuse me, I'm not trying to belittle anyone in particular. Sitting there, absolutely upright for the whole hour, and we think, "Wow, this monk here, for sure he's got it." But in fact, he has been thinking without end for the whole hour. Sitting with a straight back is no guarantee for peaceful states. So try out these teachings, all of you. If there are more questions, you can come and ask them step by step. But you really need to give it a go. Practice up to the limit. This is very important, to go as far as you can. Really, don't just do the practice lightheartedly. If all you do is play around, you won't get to peace. You won't develop wisdom. No wisdom for you. You'll keep getting misled by your kilesas. For example, you think, "I don't see anybody else practice. I seem to be the only one practicing here. There's nobody else in the Wat. I'm the only one really serious about the practice." Then after some time, you think, "I've always been so strict. If I was to relax a little more in the future, that would be okay too." You think, "Maybe I don't need to come to the meditation sessions anymore." Then you sometimes come, sometimes you don't, and in the end, you stay away completely. Eventually, when everybody stays away, whenever he likes, monastery standards, call what, are completely gone to ruin. You need to go against the stream, put up with things, patient endurance. Patience and endurance are the very qualities that you need in order to allow peace and goodness to develop. Even if you don't see it now, in the future, you'll see it for sure. It needs perseverance. At times, when I was new, I didn't experience anything special, and I also still have strong views and ideas. When I started practicing in the beginning, when I sat in meditation, there was nothing but confusion. I even started wondering about the Buddha himself, whether or not he actually became really peaceful when he was meditating. These thoughts I had weren't right. It was wrong view to question whether or not the Buddha himself was really peaceful when meditating. At this stage of meditation, to ask things like that, apparently he's expressing distraughtness. During that time, I was in fact practicing a lot. I only had 4 hours of sleep, and these 4 hours had become such fixed habits that I could tell when they were over. As soon as the 4 hours had passed, I'd get up and I would press the alarm clock I had set before it actually went off, many times every night. When I was still struggling, things are confusing. When one is still struggling, things are confusing. But sooner or later, one really ripens, always having resisted and gone against the grain. Finally, peace develops and one feels inspired. All one's efforts in the practice might finally have been quite all right. So one tries to continue in the same way, on, and it becomes more peaceful all the time. When I was new, I tried out what Lumpa Cha said, to light an incense stick and not to get up until the incense was burnt up. I was sitting there sweating, and it wasn't peaceful at all. The sweat was running down in big drops, down my whole body. I did it a lot, every day. One day, I finally found the right balance. Peace arose, and when I opened my eyes, I was surprised. Since when had the incense gone out? From then on, I finally felt encouraged. It meant that the words of the Krupa Ajahns weren't all wrong. If we only really followed them sincerely, I thought to myself that when we don't actually do what they taught us, it is ourselves that aren't sincere. It's nobody else's fault. It all depends on us. So, then I tried to sit continually, trying to overcome myself. When I was tempted to get up, I thought, I don't care. If I am supposed to die, then okay, I'll die. If my leg is to fall off, okay, let it fall off. Let it all go. That's how I thought. If my legs die off, so what? Don't care. It doesn't matter. I probably won't die. Death? Okay, go ahead. I'll die practicing. That's just what the Krupa Ajahn said. If you die while you put forth, while putting forth effort in practicing, that's better than dying while doing anything else. Doesn't matter. Believe the Krupa Ajahns and just go ahead. I went ahead until I finally found peace up to the present day, all because I believed the Krupa Ajahns. So for all of you, it's exactly the same. It's no different at all. Things such as confusion, I know them all, how they feel, how one worries, where to go, and how to carry on, even spoiling the peace that one already has. I know all of this. So all of you need to try and give a little encouragement to yourselves. If it's too much, you'll be overconfident. If it's too little, it won't work. Sorry if some of it didn't make sense. This is like a very rough translation of a talk. It's a very rough translation of a talk. So. Oh, who? Tan Ajahn Piet.
Is that from Ajahn Chandoko's name? Do you know what that came from?
I think Ajahn Chandoko was there, but it's... Just
a Dhamma talk?
Some talk that he gave, and monks from Nanachat stopped by his wat on the way to Dhamma, I think.